Welcome everyone to the Alturas Institute's presentation of America Reimagined, our radio show that invites experts from across the country to consider what America might look like under different circumstances, policies, and programs. The Alturas Institute is an educational nonprofit organization dedicated to defending American democracy by advancing the Constitution, civic education, gender equality, and equal protection of the law. I'm David Adler. It's my pleasure to serve as president of the Alturas Institute. Joining us today is Dr. Caroline Heldman, a professor from Occidental College in Los Angeles, a well-known political scientist, prominent author on the presidency, gender, and media. She is currently serving as chair of the Department of Critical Theory and Social Justice. No doubt you've seen Dr. Heldman many times on various network shows, appearing on a variety of television and radio programs, opining on current politics of great interest to Americans everywhere. She is the author of 6 books, including Protest Politics in the Marketplace. Her most recent book is Madam President, Politics and Gender on the Road to the White House. You're familiar with her appearances in acclaimed documentaries. She also is Vice President of Research and Insights at the Gina Davis Institute. She's a very busy person. We're delighted to have you with us here today. Caroline, thanks for joining us.
It's wonderful to be here, Dr. Adler. Thank you.
So your work throughout your distinguished career has, in many cases, tracked the hurdles and challenges confronting women in increased participation in American politics. And this is a year in which many, many Americans are looking forward to the impact of the vote among women in the presidential election. Could we take a few minutes to talk a little bit about the importance and significance of women in voting this year and their impact on the election?
Yeah, that's a great question, David. This year, women are an incredibly important, well, they're not a voting bloc, but they're incredibly important in determining the outcome of the election, and actually have been for a number of decades. If you look at when women got the vote, we're looking at the 19th Amendment, right, in 1920, but women and men would actually look similar in their voting patterns for the presidency all the way up until 1980, where we saw what we call the gender gap emerge. And the gender gap is the difference between the winning candidate and the number of women versus the number of men who voted for that candidate. And what we saw was that women, by and large, had much lower support for Ronald Reagan. And then again in 1984, the gap was there. We also saw another difference between men and women in that around the same period of time, in that women started to turn out to vote more. So women became more Democratic, more likely to support the Democratic candidate. They also turned out to vote at higher rates than men and have consistently for about half a century. And what's happening in this particular election is very much the product or result of a Donald Trump presidency. So if you think back to 2016, his election inspired the largest single day protest in global history, the Women's March, where you saw 3.1 million people across the globe turn out to march for women's rights. As soon as he got into office, you saw the percentage of women interested in running for office shoot up, and it wasn't all women, it's not Republican women. These gains have been on the Democratic side. You also saw more women running for Congress in 2018 and historically winning. So now we have the highest numbers of women in the House and Senate that we ever have. The number's around 25%, but I think it's important to, you know, put this into context that women are 51% of the population. So there's still a long way to go for women to be properly represented at the federal level. And of course, we've never had a female president. That having Kamala Harris on the ticket is the third time this has happened. Well, we had in 1984, Geraldine Ferraro and Walter Mondale. He added her to, I would argue, a Hail Mary ticket where it was a losing ticket and he wanted to energize it by maybe pulling in some women voters who were already not inclined to support Ronald Reagan at the same rates as men. We saw the same sort of Hail Mary with with John McCain in 2008 when he added Sarah Palin to the ticket to try to pull over some disaffected Hillary Clinton voters. Both of those on losing tickets. What's so amazing about this election is that Kamala Harris, a woman of color, a Tamil Indian woman, a black woman, has been put on a winning ticket. Biden was actually ahead when she was added. And so I think that's one aspect that is historic. I think that women are going to vote overwhelmingly Democratic for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris this year, and will likely be pivotal in the outcome of this race.
I like your point about the fact that the two previous women who have served as candidates on the as vice president are markedly different than the selection of Kamala Harris, who brings many strengths to this ticket, in many ways fortifying what voters sometimes perceive in Joe Biden as something of a lack of energy and strengths through her prosecutorial career and other experiences. Do polls show that she is a net plus for Joe Biden, and that she's bringing a lot of energy and strength to this ticket?
You know, David, why the question you ask is so important is that we now know, looking back, that that Walter Mondale, that Geraldine Ferraro was a drag on that ticket. We also know that Sarah Palin was a drag on the McCain ticket. But the polls indicate that Kamala Harris is indeed a boost to the ticket. Not only is she a boost to the ticket, she appears to be key in coalescing the Obama coalition that fell apart in 2016 for the Democrats. So if you recall, the Obama coalition brought in more diversity than we've ever seen in terms of voting for a presidential candidate across age, across race, across ideology, across genders. And that did somewhat fall apart in 2016, where we especially saw lower support for Hillary Clinton amongst men of all races. And so Kamala Harris appears, I would argue, to be key to the fact that the Obama coalition is getting behind Biden. And of course, you can't parse that out from the fact that Joe Biden was Barack Obama's, President Obama's vice president for 8 years.
That's a really important observation, Caroline. The very fact that you mentioned that this is a transition election and Joe Biden is a transition candidate, surely the addition of Kamala Harris is a point of appeal for a lot of younger voters.
Younger voters, Indian American voters, I think that's where we're seeing the biggest increase in terms of interest in and vote for the Biden ticket because of Kamala Harris's background. I think black women are going to overwhelmingly support the Biden-Harris ticket, and they are the most, you know, black women are the most consistent voters in U.S. democracy. They voted higher than any other race, gender group. I would anticipate also that people are motivated because Joe Biden said, look, I'm a bridge candidate here, and nobody thinks he's going to run again in 4 years. I mean, this really is kind of a backdoor way of getting a woman within striking distance of the presidency, which I think actually puts her in a better position, given the massive hurdles to a woman actually being elected outright into that position first off.
And do you think this is an election where suburban white women return to the Democratic ticket?
I do, and I actually think that it has more to do with Donald Trump's style. And so what we see is, you know, a siphoning of votes away from him and toward Biden or staying home. In terms of suburban voters, it's white men and women actually have similar drops, but it's important to note that these are college-educated suburban white men and women. I think it has much more to do with his style. I think if you look across the board, there's pretty broad policy support or support amongst Republicans for Donald Trump's policy. A lot of folks are not disaffected by his tone and style, but I think this particular group is. And so I think, we heard the debate last night, and Biden, I would say, quote unquote, won the debate in that I think he got, you know, the best zingers and the best kind of memeable moments. But Donald Trump did exactly what he needed to do, which was look presidential, look calm, talk about policy. And I think had he had that tone throughout this campaign, that he would be doing much better among suburban voters.
We live, obviously, in the era of the Me Too movement. Are women having a very hard time voting for Donald Trump, given his crude statements, his vulgarisms, his misogyny? Is this a real difficult point for the Trump campaign to overcome, something they cannot overcome?
I think that it's already disaffected the people it's going to disaffect, if that makes sense. He has lost He has lost women voters. He's lost support amongst women. It was a surprise to me going into the 2016 election that his support, for example, amongst white women was as high as it was at 53%, mostly because, you know, he had 23 allegations of pretty serious sexual violence and misconduct. He also, you know, you have a tape where you hear him boasting about something that in all 50 states would be considered sexual battery. And yet, you know, there was this, and we see this in politics, where there was this pledge to race, essentially, that his women were, some white women prioritized the way he made them feel about race and the way he made them feel about their place in society over their gender concerns. And we do see this happening throughout, you know, certainly throughout modern U.S. history. I would be surprised if it has affected anyone at this point, because you know who he is. But with that said, there has been a pretty steady drift away from him in terms of women, which is why you hear him getting behind the podiums at these rallies and saying, you know, he's joking, but he's saying suburban white women, why can't, he's not saying white, he's saying suburban women, but that's what he means. Why don't you vote for me? Why don't you like me? So I think maybe the crass language, in addition to the fact that he now has about 45, and not about, there are 45 allegations of sexual misconduct. So that hasn't gone away. We really haven't litigated that. We haven't discussed that as a country. He hasn't been held accountable. So this is a long way of saying, I think perhaps in some way he is finally being held accountable by some Republican women.
You know, to broaden our discussion a little bit, Caroline, as you know, often elections are characterized either as an issues election or sometimes as a character issue. Does this particular campaign strike you to be one or the other in the main?
I think it's an issue election. I think it's a referendum on COVID. Mm-hmm. If you look at polling, the top issue, obviously, is the pandemic. 220,000 Americans dead, at least. That's the low-end estimate. We are headed into what the experts are predicting might be a doubling of that by the end of the year, given the fact that people will be inside with shared circulated air, given the fact that, you know, while heat doesn't make COVID disappear, we know that it thrives in cold weather. And so I think it's very clear that the American public, by and large majority, are not happy with Donald Trump's response. You look at the polls, and about 61% say that he has done a terrible job responding to this, and he has. Let's be frank, I don't care what political party you're with. He waited 71 days to act. Even the small step that he took to stop travel from China. It was a porous ban. There were about 43,000 people who were coming and going during the period after the ban. We don't have a national policy. He didn't support the states the way that he needed to. He still is not promoting mask wearing, which, if we shut down for 1 month, according to Andy Slavitt, who was in the Obama White House, who headed all of this up, shut down for 1 month, like really stay inside, and then we masked full time, we really could make serious inroads in bringing this pandemic, you know, not to a stop, but certainly we could lower the death rate considerably. And right now the death rate is spiking in red states. It's spiking in rural areas. And I wonder, you know, why he waited so long to do anything and then had a tepid response. And, you know, Joe Biden thinks it's because he was looking at the stock market. That's a possibility. I also think it was because it was maybe hitting in blue states and it took a while to get to red states, or, you know, it was disproportionately affecting Black and Latinx Americans. I don't know why he waited, but I will tell you it's unconscionable to have 220,000 Americans dead, regardless of whatever political party you're affiliated with.
You know, I like your identification of multiple factors, perhaps to explain the unconscionable delay in seriously addressing the COVID problem here in the country. And that's a critical issue, as you point out. Other critical issues include the status of healthcare in this country, how people feel about the loss of America's reputation abroad, and then, of course, the heartbreaking news that some 545 children have been separated from their parents at the border by virtue of Trump's policies. These are issues that weigh heavily on the electorate in this election as well, don't you think?
I would agree, and I would put the climate crisis up there as well. We have, you know, young people tend to vote at much lower rates than, you know, people my age or older. But millennials and Generation Z are so massive that even their lower voting rates have an effect in the election. And if you ask them what the number one issue is, it's existence. It's the climate crisis. And so I think that is also going to play a role with that age group. And I would also, just looking in terms of the policies that Americans care a lot about, folks are certainly concerned about healthcare. They're also concerned about racial division in this country. And racial division has increased dramatically under the Trump presidency. And last night we heard him claim that he had done more than anyone but Abraham Lincoln on this issue. It's simply not factually accurate. If you look at where people are, if you look at opinion polls, if you look at the divisiveness of our rhetoric, and especially through social media, you will find that we are more racially divided today than we have been in the modern political era. And so you have to lay that at Trump's feet with his rhetoric. He is not the only cause, but he has certainly fanned the flames of racial division in this country.
You know, as we think about all of these issues, and you quite rightly raise the issue of race, how might you explain, as a political scientist, Donald Trump's propensity for his difficult relationship with the truth, his propensity for misstatements, half-truths, and lies?
It is hard to say why he engages in these actions. I think maybe because he's not held accountable for it. So even though the Washington Post has now identified over 20,000 mistruths and lies since he started his campaign, you know, leading into 2016, it doesn't seem to matter. In fact, folks left, right, and center know that he lies and dismiss it, or instead of it being a front and center issue that we have a public official whose word we cannot trust, we've kind of accepted that and moved on. And maybe it's because there's an exhaustion from his approach to presidenting, right? He's bending the rules, he's bending the Constitution, constantly under investigation with his staff. There are so many things coming at the American public that I think, and this isn't your question, but I think that a lot of folks are just really looking forward to not thinking about the presidency all the time. And the fact that we don't even think about the fact that he lies all the time, we just accept it, is an indicator of that exhaustion.
Mm-hmm. Interesting observation. Shifting ground slightly, as a presidential scholar, as a political scientist, as a citizen, how do you feel about President Trump's comments, for example, that he is reluctant at least to commit to a peaceful transition to power, that he has absolute power under Article 2, that, for example, he has absolute power to pardon himself, and other such assertions. How do those claims strike you?
Well, I'm worried about the idea that he is openly saying he doesn't want to peacefully transition power. I think that is as far, not I think, I know that is as far as any president has gone in terms of getting close to a coup. And we have a coup if a couple of things happen, right? We have a coup if he does not allow, or his team does not allow the votes to be recounted, or to be recounted, to be counted, and then perhaps recounted if that's the case. So if he stops the vote, we're in a coup. If he looks at the results and he doesn't like the results and he rejects them, we are in a coup. I mean, there are a number of scenarios where we could be in serious trouble. And the problem with Donald Trump's pattern is that he violates the norms, he violates the traditions that have held this office in place. I would say he even violates the Constitution outright with the Emoluments Clause and a few other clauses, and he has not been held accountable for that. So I worry that we are in a position that if he goes beyond this simple incendiary rhetoric that he is going to launch a coup, that he actually will, and we won't know what to do about that. And so I know a lot of folks are saying, you know, what do you do? First of all, you call it a coup. Secondly, it's good to note that coups, you know, only 50% of them are successful. Although if you look at that another way, 50% of coups are successful, right? Where you have a non-democratically elected leader in place. So what do? You take to the streets, you shut things down. You peacefully take to the streets, and then you shut things down. You refuse to go to work. If that happens, we need to be prepared for that. I don't think the American public is prepared for that. I don't think there's enough knowledge about what a coup is. I don't think people will label it a coup when it's happening right in front of us. So I have a lot of concerns about our ability as a country after 3.5 years of the chaos and the exhaustion to adequately address this if it happens. My only kind of silver lining is, I think, of hope, is that other Republicans will not put up with it, even though they have enabled him for a very long time. And a lot of these, you know, the bending and stretching of the Constitution, I think that once he's actually lost the election, if that happens, that they will step in and do something. You already see a little bit of it peeling off now. You see senators going against Donald Trump who just wouldn't have dreamt of doing that a year ago, right? Because we're getting close to the election, and I think it doesn't look good for him, at least on paper. I also think that he is disaffected the military, so that is another possible route or response. I don't know that they would let that happen. Who the big they? Normally, Democratic presidents and candidates are outfavored by Republicans amongst the military 2-1, right? So the 18 million veterans and the 2 million active service members tend to favor Republicans 2-1. But right now, they actually favor Joe Biden over Donald Trump, mostly because of his comments and not visiting, you know, that, you know, what does this bring you to be a soldier, essentially, and not honoring the sacrifice of soldiers and not wanting to go to a military cemetery. All of that has hurt him substantially. Also, when you look at the Military Times poll on this, his decision, Donald Trump's decision to send in federal troops to address protesters was wildly unpopular in the rank and file military as well as the brass. And so, I don't know, there are some moments of hope that there might be a backstop against a breach of our democracy, but the very fact that you and I are having this conversation means we're in a place we shouldn't be.
You've recited a very long list of profound concerns that plumb the depths of American democracy. And I'm wondering, do you see this election as having any parallels, for example, to the immediate post-Watergate feeling and attitude in America, where after Richard Nixon, Americans were longing for someone decent and a restoration of honesty and a certain appreciation for truth? Do you see any parallels between, let us say, the election of Jimmy Carter, who represented those views, at least among a wide body of Americans, and the appeal of Joe Biden as a person who strikes people as an honest, decent man?
You know, that's a great parallel to draw, David. I find Jimmy Carter and Joe Biden to be profoundly boring candidates who are calm and steady and have some policy ideas and you know, Biden will probably be somewhat effective depending upon the balance of the Senate. I think that parallel is reasonable to draw amongst Biden supporters, but I think what differentiates this particular election is the reasons why Trump appeals to his supporters. And his diehard supporters are about 1 in 3 Americans. And as I wrote in 2016, and I, you know, will double down today, he speaks to a group of Americans who believe that they have been left behind as women and people of color have made progress in this country, right? So Donald Trump is speaking a politics of fear, where he makes people feel better about losing power or the belief that they've lost power. He makes them feel better about it. He makes them feel as though they're entitled to that power and that it's theirs to have and not others, right? So as the culture has shifted, he is speaking to those who are fearful because they think they've been left behind. And you see this in his rhetoric about, you know, Mexicans being rapists and quote unquote Mexican judges not being able to be unbiased, and his immigration policy and his Muslim ban. The fact that we elected Donald Trump, who is the titular head of the birther movement, after 8 years of a black president, speaks volumes, right? And I really do think that Barack Obama's presidency was a bit of a tipping point for a lot of white Americans who were so fearful of this shift. And Donald Trump gives them, you know, he throws out, you know, I will say it directly, you know, a racist lifeboat. He tells them, don't worry, you know, you're still better than. And that is his rhetoric. Whether he's talking about race or he's talking about gender, that is his rhetoric. And so it's in some way, it sounds like I'm being very critical of a third of Americans who have, by the way, empirically higher levels, far significantly higher levels of racial resentment and higher levels of traditional and conventional sexism than other Americans. But really, these are my people. I grew up with these people and I understand this dynamic, I think. It really is based in fear. It's implicit, mostly. It's not explicit. And I'm not making excuses for it, but I really think we need to understand why Donald Trump was so appealing. And I think it's kind of obvious if we just acknowledge the role that racism and sexism and this fear of being left behind is playing. It wasn't economic anxiety, by the way, and that was the big story of the 2016 election. It's just inaccurate. That's not what the data say. The data say that it was driven by racial resentment and sexism, and that economic anxiety played very little role. In fact, during the primary especially, Donald Trump's voters made more money on average than the average American. So these are not folks who are economically disadvantaged. If you look at it by and large, obviously there are exceptions when you're talking about aggregate data, but Hillary Clinton appealed to those who make $30,000 or less at a higher rate than Donald Trump. So yeah, I think we need to grapple with what actually happened in 2016 and why 92% of Republicans are sticking with Donald Trump after 3.5 years of what we can all acknowledge has been pretty chaotic.
We live in unprecedented times. I really appreciate your candor and your reliance on statistics to further illuminate what exactly the data suggests to us. I'm so sorry that our time together has gone by so quickly, Caroline. I would like to extend this for another 5 or 6 hours, and perhaps another day we'll have a chance to bring you back to our show. Ladies and gentlemen, you're watching America Reimagined. We are so grateful to Dr. Caroline Heldman, an award-winning author and teacher at Occidental College. We appreciate your participation today. Again, thank you, Caroline.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains.
Audio and guest information for all episodes of America Reimagined can be found at kisu.org. Production assistance is provided by Taylor Nadal and Mandy Gardner. For more information about the Alturas Institute, visit alturasinstitute.com. Our rendition of America the Beautiful is a new arrangement created by the talented musician Steve Eaton and sung by Idaho State Senator Sherry Buckner Webb and 8-year-old Charlotte Laval.
From sea.